Today is Friday, July 9th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinua Adofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. pledges to help find killers of Haiti's president.
Haiti's police killed four mercenaries and took into custody two others who police say were responsible for Wednesday's attack.
Plus, President Biden sticks with plan to withdraw U.S. forces from Afghanistan.
I will not send another generation of Americans to war in Afghanistan with no reasonable expectation of achieving a different outcome.
Also, UN calls for international pressure on Myanmar military. Our top story today is in Haiti. The United States says it will respond to requests for help in investigating the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. Experts say the U.S. should resist any temptation to intervene militarily in Haiti, as it has in times of past upheaval. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Haiti's police killed four mercenaries and took into custody two others who police say were responsible for Wednesday's attack that killed President Jovenel Moïse and injured his wife in their private residence. Police say more members of the killer commando team are still on the loose. They did not say what the motive was for the attack that has thrown the impoverished country into political turmoil. In Washington, State Department spokesperson Ned Price said the U.S. is sending help, most likely in the form of law enforcement.
We are aware that the Haitian National Police requests for investigative assistance, and the United States is responding.
At the White House, Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the U.S. supports democratic institutions in Haiti.
It is our view, and we continue to call for elections to happen this year, and we believe they should proceed. We know that free and fair elections will facilitate a peaceful transfer of power to a newly elected president, and we certainly continue to support Haiti's democratic institutions.
For now, though, Haiti finds itself in a political vacuum, with no president, prime minister, or functioning parliament. Acting Prime Minister Claude Joseph has declared a state of siege, as Haiti expert Brian Concannon explains.
It's mostly justified as a way to pursue the killers. Is intended to last for 2 weeks, but it can be renewed, and it allows the police and others to warrantless searches, which of course is troubling. And there's also limits circulation. It basically imposes a curfew for the 2 weeks, and it also has some very broad provisions that could be subject to abuse. It allows the police basically to do anything necessary to pursue the killers.
Concannon said the U.S. has a long history of military intervention in Haiti, but should resist any potential temptation to send troops into the void now.
If you look at the most recent intervention, the U.S. did an intervention in 2004, and then that was followed up by a U.N. peacekeeping mission. That mission stayed in Haiti for 14 years. It spent $17 billion. At the end of that, more guns and less democracy in Haiti than before the intervention arrived. The U.N. soldiers, they brought cholera to Haiti that killed 10,000 people. They were involved in widespread sexual exploitation and abuse.
As authorities in Haiti seek to find those responsible for the assassination, the attack creates more uncertainty for its citizens, who are already suffering under soaring inflation and escalating gang violence. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
A heavily armed commando unit that assassinated Haitian President Jovenel Moïse this week comprised 26 Colombians and two Haitian Americans, authorities said on Thursday, as the hunt went on for the masterminds of the killing. Eve Johnson of Reuters reports.
In Haiti, a group of handcuffed men were paraded before the media on Thursday. Suspects, police said, in the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. Authorities called them a commando unit, trained and heavily armed, and said they were all foreigners, including 26 Colombians and two Haitian Americans. Also on display, assault rifles, machetes, bolt cutters, and Colombian passports. Police held the press event following a raid on a house near the scene of the crime. They said three suspects have been killed, with eight still on the run. Moïse was fatally shot at his home Wednesday, a massive blow for a country already struggling with crushing poverty, political chaos, and gang violence. Colombia's defense minister said there was preliminary evidence that the Colombian suspects were retired military.
The national government, our police and army have given instructions for immediate collaboration. The complete cooperation of our forces is with our fellow Republic of Haiti.
Authorities have identified the American suspects, but the U.S. State Department has not confirmed they are citizens. Haiti's police claim the local community helped track down the suspected killers, but have called for residents not to take justice into their own hands. After a violent crowd gathered at the Port-au-Prince police station where the suspects were being held, President Moïse had faced mass protests against his rule, accused of corruption and refusing to let go of power. Authorities declared a state of emergency following his killing, but interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph on Thursday said it was time to reopen the economy and called for the airport to restart operations.
That's Eve Johnson of Reuters. Amid major Taliban gains on the ground on Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden delivered his justification for military withdrawal from Afghanistan. The U.S. is on track to pull out troops completely by the end of August, ending military operations after two decades of war. White House correspondent Patsy Widas-Kuwara has this report.
Afghan forces firing shots in the capital of Badghis province after the Taliban stormed the city, their most brazen assault since the United States stepped up its troop withdrawal. Thousands of American troops and contractors left Bagram airfield last week, effectively ending U.S. military operations that began in 2001. On Thursday, President Joe Biden delivered his justification.
After 20 years, $1 trillion spent training and equipping hundreds of thousands of Afghan national security and defense forces, 2,448 Americans killed, 20,722 more wounded, and untold thousands coming home with unseen trauma to their mental health. I will not send another generation of Americans to war in Afghanistan with no reasonable expectation of achieving a different outcome.
U.S. officials said the withdrawal will be completed by the end of August. Biden ordered it in April, concluding the U.S. has succeeded in degrading the threat of al-Qaeda, the group that attacked the U.S. on September 11, 2001. But with increasing Taliban attacks on key cities, many are concerned about the possibility of the Afghan government collapsing.
I don't think the Afghan military is as bad as some people paint them to be, but at the same time, I'm not sure they have the power to keep the Taliban from creating an all-out civil war, which would be an absolute tragedy for Afghanistan.
Biden said the U.S. will continue to support the Afghan military, provide humanitarian assistance, and help protect women's rights. But he insisted that Afghan leadership must come together.
We did not go to Afghanistan to nation build. And it's the right and the responsibility of the Afghan people alone to decide their future and how they want to run their country.
Around 600 American troops will remain to guard the airport and U.S. embassy in Kabul. Analysts say there are other steps the U.S. can take to keep the Afghan government from collapsing.
We can find a way to get the Western contractors either back in Afghanistan in a safe part of the country or close by to keep the Afghan Air Force operational. If we keep the money flowing to support the Afghan military, and if we consider perhaps even using a limited amount of American air power against any big Taliban onslaught against cities, there is a chance that we can help the Afghan government hold on to large chunks of the country.
Meanwhile, thousands of Afghans are trying to flee the country, crowding the passport office in Kabul and hoping to secure exit visas before the U.S. withdrawal. Efforts are underway to relocate tens of thousands of Afghan interpreters and others who helped American forces. The administration said it has identified U.S. facilities outside of the continental United States and third countries where they will be housed temporarily while their special immigrant visas are processed. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Russia's foreign ministry on Friday said the Taliban currently controls more than two-thirds of the border between Afghanistan and Tajikistan. The ministry called on all sides of the Afghan conflict to show restraint and said that Russia and Moscow-led CSTO military bloc would act decisively to prevent aggression and provocations on the border. A United Nations investigator is calling for coordinated international action to stem abuse by Myanmar's military leaders against its people. In a report to the UN Human Rights Council, the UN Special Rapporteur lists measures for bringing the country's generals into compliance with international human rights norms. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Human rights investigator Tom Andrews accuses the international community of failing the people of Myanmar. In an impassioned speech to the UN Council, he presented documented evidence of widespread systematic attacks by the military junta against the people of Myanmar. Since the junta's overthrow of the country's democratically elected government 5 months ago, he says military forces have killed about 900 people. He says they have forcibly displaced hundreds of thousands, tortured many, and arbitrarily detained nearly 6,000 people.
Some in Myanmar have lost hope that help from the international community will be forthcoming and have instead sought to defend themselves through the formation of defense forces and acts of sabotage, while some are reportedly targeting suspected junta collaborators and officials. And the junta's pattern of the use of grossly disproportionate force in response will likely lead to an even greater loss of life.
Andrew says the people of Myanmar desperately need the support of the international community to end this nightmare. Yet he says little action has been taken beyond international protestations of condemnation, the imposition of sanctions by some nations, and resolutions by UN bodies. The UN investigator is calling for the establishment of a so-called emergency coalition for the people of Myanmar. The plan proposes a series of 5 key measures he says would impose significant costs on the junta. First and foremost, he asserts cutting off the junta's source of income could reduce its ability to attack its citizens. Therefore, he is calling on nations to impose economic sanctions on Myanmar's oil and gas industry.
Oil and gas sector revenues are a financial lifeline for the junta and are estimated to be close to what is needed for the junta to maintain the security forces that are keeping them in power. They should be stopped. Second, an emergency coalition for the people of Myanmar could outlaw the export of arms to the Myanmar military as called for in last month's General Assembly resolution.
The plan also calls for the pursuit of universal jurisdiction cases and filing charges against Myanmar's senior security officials. Other measures include ensuring that humanitarian aid goes directly to the people of Myanmar and the denial of any claims of legitimacy by the junta, such as the false claim that it is recognized by the United Nations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coronavirus infections are rising in Australia despite a 2-week-old lockdown intended to stop the spread. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports officials are now focusing on how to enforce compliance with COVID-19 lockdown rules, particularly where such restrictions appear to be mostly ignored.
Millions of people in Sydney and surrounding regions were ordered into a COVID-19 lockdown 2 weeks ago. Detected cases of the highly contagious Delta variant have continued to rise, though. Authorities have said that strict stay-at-home orders in some of Australia's most ethnically diverse areas in Sydney have been widely flouted, although charities have said community health messages for some migrant groups have been inadequate. A major police operation is underway in parts of Sydney to ensure the rules are followed. Officers on horseback are expected to patrol main shopping areas. Senior commanders have denied the crackdown is targeting multicultural areas. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison says too many people have broken the rules.
We haven't seen the compliance that has been necessary. It's important to get that compliance in place. The virus doesn't move on its own. It moves by people moving the virus around. And that's why it's so important that the restrictions that have been put in place that are appropriate just need to be complied with.
Under Sydney's lockdown, which is due to end on July 16, residents can only leave home to work, study, buy groceries, care for a relative or other dependent, or receive a COVID-19 vaccination. Starting Friday, people will only be able to exercise in groups of 2 and do so within 10 kilometres of their homes. The New South Wales Chief Health Officer, Dr. Kerry Chant, is urging residents to stay home.
People are looking at countries overseas where they're seeing people go about their work and pleasure in a sort of semi-normal way. And I think that is really important to highlight. That's because those countries have got vaccination coverages for their adult population, and in some cases down in the childhood population, that is very different from our situation. We have only got 9% vaccination coverage.
Health officials have estimated there are 513 active coronavirus infections in Australia. 92 patients are in the hospital. New South Wales, including the state capital Sydney, recorded another 44 new infections Friday. Australia has recorded almost 31,000 COVID-19 cases and 910 deaths since the pandemic began. Its international borders remain closed to most foreign nationals. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Since the outbreak of COVID-19 started in 2019, we've learned a lot about the virus, who is most vulnerable, how to better treat COVID-19 patients, and how the virus works. Researchers are also discovering how the virus manipulates the body's immune system and evades its defenses, as we learn from this report from VOA's Carol Pearson.
When a virus invades the body, the immune system immediately launches an attack. But COVID-19 seems to be able to fool our immune systems. Michaela Gack is the scientific director and chair of Cleveland Clinic's Innovation and Research Center in Florida. She likens the immune system to a home alarm system that a burglar disables.
Basically, the invader, in this case, the COVID-19 virus, disables the alarm system in the house and thereby can freely, you know, replicate in the human body and spread.
Gack says this happens almost immediately after infection.
Another key feature of this virus is that it can escape the human immune response. This high transmissibility of the virus combined with that it can evade antibody responses really makes it quite alarming.
What makes the virus even more alarming is its more contagious and more serious Delta variant, which is spreading quickly around the world. The Delta variant has become the dominant strain in the U.S. In her lab, Gack's team is studying COVID-19's evasion technique, which she says appears to be unique. She says the technique provides clues for developing medication to fight it.
Targeting this enzyme of COVID-19 of the virus would actually, on the one hand, directly block the virus, but it would also restore or even boost our immune system. So it would have this dual function, what I believe could be very beneficial in terms of therapeutics.
Gack and her team are working with other researchers at several other labs. If successful, they might come up with new ways to treat patients with COVID-19, as well as those infected with another coronavirus, or they might discover new treatments for those suffering from other diseases that start with a virus, such as some cancers. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
This is the Voice of America. A South African court has rejected former South African President Jacob Zuma's request to postpone his jail term. Zuma, who started his 15-month jail sentence Thursday, will remain behind bars after his application for his prison term be delayed was dismissed by the Pietermaritzburg High Court on Friday. Zuma has one more legal bid to be released, which will be heard by the Constitutional Court, the country's top court. He's imprisoned in the Escort Correctional Center for failing to obey a court order to testify at a judicial commission that is investigating allegations of corruption during his term as president from 2009 to 2018. Jihan Sadat, widow of former Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, the first Arab leader to make peace with Israel, has died. She was 87. In recent weeks, the Egyptian media reported that Jihan had been hospitalized and was battling cancer. Born in 1933, Jihan Safwat Raouf married Sadat, then a military officer, in 1949. During his presidency, she pushed for legislation protecting women's rights. After her husband was assassinated by Islamic extremists in 1981, she likely withdrew from public life before re-emerging in later years as a commentator on the region's conflicts. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Ahead of South Sudan's 10th year of independence, the UN Children's Fund warns the country is facing a catastrophic humanitarian situation with 2 out of 3 children in need of international aid. Lisa Schneier reports for VOA from Geneva.
South Sudan's joyous Independence Day celebration on July 9, 2011, were short-lived. 2 years later, civil war erupted. The awful legacy of that war, which is estimated to have killed nearly 400,000 people, lives on today. The United Nations reports 1.6 million people are internally displaced and 2.2 million people who fled across borders as refugees remain in exile. The UN Children's Fund reports 8.3 million people, including a record 4.5 million children, are in desperate need of humanitarian support. Speaking on a shaky video link from the capital, Juba, UNICEF Chief of Field Operations in South Sudan, Mads Oyen, says the country is suffering from multiple man-made and natural disasters. These include bouts of violence and intercommunal conflicts, revenge killings, recurring floods and droughts, and a worsening economy.
South Sudan is really one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world and one of the most forgotten. We have the highest percentage of children in need in the world as part of the total population.
UNICEF reports South Sudan is breaking several unfortunate records. It notes 1 in 10 children are not expected to reach their 5th birthday. This is one of the highest child mortality rates in the world. It says about 1.4 million children are expected to suffer from life-threatening acute malnutrition this year, the highest figure since 2013. Oyen says UNICEF and partners have shown they can save many children's lives if given the resources to provide early therapeutic treatment to them.
90,000 children suffering from severe acute malnutrition throughout the country were treated, and we have a recovery rate more than 95%. So a child who is severely acutely malnourished is a disaster, but the treatment is very effective.
Although successful treatment for this condition is available, Oyen says it would be better to prevent children from becoming malnourished in the first place. He says UNICEF would like to scale up its nutritional programs for children and improve access to clean water. He says other priorities include improving sanitation and hygiene and access to basic health. But funds are limited. He says UNICEF has received only 1/3 of the $180 million it needs to assist South Sudan's most vulnerable children this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Using a toilet can pay for your coffee or buy you bananas at a university in South Korea, where excrement is being used to help power a building. Choi Jian-Weon, an urban and environmental engineering professor at the Osan National Institute of Science and Technology, has designed an eco-friendly toilet connected to a laboratory that uses human waste to produce biogas and fertilizer. The BEVI toilet, a portmanteau of the word B and vision, uses a vacuum pump to send feces into an underground tank, reducing water use. There, microorganisms break down the waste to methane, which becomes a source of energy for the building, powering a gas stove, hot water boiler, and solid oxide fuel cell. There are 3 of the toilets in a campus building that opened in 2018. Cho has devised a virtual currency called Jigul, which means honey in Korean. Each person using the eco-friendly toilet earns 10 Jigul a day. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great weekend.